Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The House of Representatives passes sweeping financial reform. It now heads to the Senate. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says it brings responsibility to bear on big banks.
This legislation makes common sense reforms that end the era of taxpayer bailouts and too big to fail financial firms.
Confirming Kagan, Supreme Court nominee Elena Kagan makes her case for the job. Alabama Republican Jeff Sessions questions her honesty.
I know what happened at Harvard. I know you an outspoken leader against the military policy. I know you acted without legal authority.
And President Obama signals he's ready to take on immigration reform.
Fixing our broken immigration system is not only a political issue, not just an economic issue, but a moral imperative as well.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines, and you can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? What do the new jobs numbers and the vote on financial reform say to you about the economic recovery? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We've got a great panel here today. Joining me from Washington, D.C. is Gail Chadwick, congressional reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, always good to have you with us.
Thank you.
And with us from Washington as well is Amy Sullivan, contributing writer to Time magazine. Amy, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Jane. It's good to be here.
Thank you. And also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, as always, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Jane, Gail, and Amy.
So let's begin with the fresh numbers out this morning on jobs. The U.S. economy shed 125,000 jobs in June. The unemployment rate remains high. Help clarify and explain those numbers for us. Amy Sullivan?
Well, as we know, some of those jobs that were lost, and in fact, most of them seem to have come from the temporary census workers that the federal government hired to do a few months' worth of work. So what we're actually seeing is a settling back. Some of the increase in jobs numbers that we'd seen over the last few months were actually kind of goosed by those temporary jobs in the census area. And so what we saw overall was actually an adding of about 83,000 jobs in the private sector. That's somewhat less than what had been projected, but it still brings the unemployment rate slightly down, just a tick, to about 9.5% right now from the previous month.
Gail Chadwick, what does it all signal to you about the pace of economic recovery in the U.S.?
It's going to be very difficult. There is a sense, especially in the Congress now, of tremendous pessimism. Both, it's almost as if the issues confronting them are coming in so rapidly that even when things were working and functioning, it would be hard to deal with. But the Senate especially is not functional now. The death of Robert Byrd, just another of the latest, you know, how do we find another Democratic vote to get things through that really ought to be moving but right now just can't.
Here's President Obama on Wednesday using a town hall meeting in Wisconsin to push the Recovery Act and blaming Republicans for doing little to jumpstart this economy.
The truth is, from the day we walked into the White House, we knew that the crisis we faced was so severe that it was going to take months and maybe even years to fully heal, to dig ourselves out of one of the worst recessions in our history. And that's why I've been fighting, in addition to everything we've done, for additional steps to speed up this recovery and keep the economy growing.
Jack Beatty, how do you see these new numbers this morning?
Well, when you paint them against the backdrop of this Pew study released this week of unemployment, it really brings home the severity and depth of this unemployment crisis. It's almost an unemployment culture. 55% of all American adults have suffered a spell of unemployment, pay cuts in hours, involuntary, that is part-time work, 55% since this recession began. And if you count in the underemployed, voluntarily underemployed. With the unemployed, we're at 16.6%, which is if you go back to 1937, that's probably what it was then in the Depression. Half of Americans say they're in worse financial shape now than they were before the recession began. There's been the largest meltdown in household wealth since the Second World War in this crisis. And half of people say that the value of their houses have declined. And I think most poignantly, really, and perhaps even ominously for the future, most people have lower expectations of their children's future. This is a crisis that's just not in the numbers. It's in the psychology. It's in the habits. It's in the hearts of people all over the country. And meanwhile, for the third time, the Republican filibuster, joined by one Democrat in the Senate, has stopped an extension of unemployment to long-term unemployed.
Well, let's hear more about that, Jack. Senate Republicans, as you say, filibustered on Wednesday to defeat that bill extending unemployment benefits. Here's Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky explaining why Republicans could not support that bill.
We've offered ways of paying for these programs, and we've been eager to approve them. But we can't support job-killing taxes and adding tens of billions to the already unsustainable national debt.
Gail Chadwick, Senate Republicans defeated the bill because they didn't want to add to the deficit. What were some of their funding ideas?
Well, they would like to see cuts in spending. They feel that the whole stimulus has not been successful. Their evidence for that is that we're still having difficulties. They're kind of in a post-Keynesian frame of mind here, and they're just looking for cuts. And it's you did see in Wednesday's vote the two senators from Maine, Susan Collins, Olympia Snowe, vote with the Democrats. And I think the other point that Republicans are making about this is, look, we had a bipartisan deal back in 2009, and Harry Reid, the majority leader, rejected it. And they've kind of been digging in ever since against any additional things that are added to this bill that has broad support. Some of the tax extenders in this package, like research credits, I mean, this has very broad support on both sides of the aisle. The fighting is over additional spending. And right now, the fighting is over the midterm elections. Mm-hmm.
And so, Amy Sullivan, what happens now as Congress heads for this long Independence Day break? When will they address this again?
Well, they will need to turn back to it again when they get back. This was for a two-week extension, which didn't go through. So there are about 2 million people who will go for 2 weeks without getting any benefits. And you have to wonder whether these Republican members of Congress are going to hear about it when they're back in their districts on their 4th of July breaks. Because as Jack lays out, this really is not an economic crisis that's affecting just a few people around the country. The effects have been incredibly widespread, and it's kind of stunning, in fact. And so you could ask, I think, legitimately, whether this is a good political move for Republicans to be making. They're arguing essentially, in addition to the deficit argument, that providing unemployment benefits gives people a disincentive to look for a job. But that's only really true when there are more than enough jobs to go around. Right now, this is a matter of getting people through their mortgage payments, getting them able to pay their grocery bills. And it's a kind of an unusual political argument to be making during an election year. You know, Harry Reid does not miss the chance to hammer them every time this happens. But the White House has been kind of strangely silent on the issue. You would think they would be able to bring it up, but they seem a little spooked by the deficit argument, and that's kind of hard to understand right now.
Why do you think that is, Jack Beatty?
I really can't fathom it. I think that according to the Financial Times, Peter Orszag, the budget director, he was going to resign anyway, but he speeded up his resignation out of frustration with the White House. He wanted a clearer note on deficit reduction. But I think the White House is genuinely caught. Yes, we have a long-term budget and debt problem. Our short-term problem is we have a stuttering and stalled economy, which is costing people their livelihoods and their homes. And the classic answer is to spend, is to stimulate. And of course, it's been pointed out again and again, unemployment compensation insurance is the most effective stimulant. For every dollar that goes out, the treasury, it stimulates $1.93 in private sector activity. So yes, the White House should get behind it, but I really don't think they've quite figured out where they fit. What their line should be going forward. Should we talk about more stimulus, or should we start talking about deficit reduction now?
Here's a caller on this point panel, Harry in Springfield, Kentucky. Hi, Harry. Welcome to On Point.
Now, I just want to make a comment over and above the immediate economic crisis. I just think that young people just entering the job market, have to think about all this in a little different way than their predecessors did. I don't think that people can any longer plan on necessarily working at the same company for years and years. I think people have to think more in terms of going into business for themselves, working temporary jobs, hate to say it, two or three jobs at a time, maybe part-time jobs, but they have to be a little more entrepreneurial in their attitude.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think many young people are really prepared or primed to think that way. I'd like to hear the panelists comment on that.
Harry, thank you. And as we go to break, Gail Chadwick, where is the hope beyond that point that Harry makes for these millions now of unemployed Americans who are not getting their benefits?
Well, I think that advice, it reminds me of what President Carter said back in 1980, that unemployed workers should simply move to where the jobs are. Go south, young man. A lot of people did, but they cut themselves off from the family networks that could have supported them through difficult times. Those are the trade-offs. They're tough.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the week in the news this week, and it has been a busy one. I'm here today with Amy Sullivan of Time Magazine, Gail Chadwick of the Christian Science Monitor, and our own Jack Beatty. Let's move to General Petraeus and the U.S. Senate voting on Wednesday unanimously to confirm him as the new commander of the Afghanistan war. During his confirmation hearings, General Petraeus promised to protect the soldiers fighting in Afghanistan.
I want to assure the mothers and fathers of those fighting in Afghanistan that I see it as a moral imperative to bring all assets to bear to protect our men and women in uniform and the Afghan security forces with whom ISAF troopers are fighting shoulder to shoulder. Those on the ground must have all the support they need when they are in a tough situation.
Gail Chadwick, General Petraeus said he would review the curbs on airstrikes and artillery in Afghanistan, which have been widely criticized by U.S. troops who say it makes their jobs more dangerous. Is this a departure from General Stanley McChrystal's focus on cutting down on civilian casualties there?
No, I think there are the two of them, and I think the White House presentation of the two of them, are standing pretty shoulder to shoulder on that. They both support an approach to counterinsurgency that actually has broad bipartisan support. But the problem is they're moving into an extremely difficult time. This stepping up of forces on Kandahar, everyone expects to have many more American casualties just before a midterm election. And you could see the tension. In a sense, the nomination, confirmation of General Petraeus was unanimous. But if you listen to the debate inside that confirmation, there are some big rifts emerging between even among those who support that approach, especially over the deadline. Mm. You know, Senator Levin, that deadline is very important to focus the attention of the Afghan government. Senator McCain, that deadline will destroy any effort to hold allies together and to move this to a successful conclusion. So I think you saw in that unanimous vote the elements of a major rift in the next few months.
Amy Sullivan, how do you see the rifts or the fault lines that may have been revealed this week over the way forward in Afghanistan?
Well, as Gil pointed out, there are still some extremely serious questions most pressingly, what that timeline is going to be and whether it has any flexibility to move at all, that really set up not only the midterm election but Obama's reelection. By putting General Petraeus in this job, he's definitely kind of eased some of the tension that had existed with General McChrystal, and that certainly came to at least public awareness in the last week. But he's also handed over the reins of Afghanistan and his strategy there to General Petraeus, who holds a lot of the cards now. And that's going to be obviously something that the White House is going to be working on, but extremely nervous about, because we have not seen many signs from Afghanistan. And even today, with the bombing of an office funded by USAID and the killing of a couple foreign workers there, we see that there continues to be an extremely high level of violence in Afghanistan, and no real movement towards getting good cooperation from the Afghanistan government.
Jack Beatty, there are two important studies out this week regarding Afghanistan. Tell us about them.
Yes. In the Rolling Stone article, one of General McChrystal's aides, unidentified, said something like, if Americans paid attention to this war, paid more attention to it, they'd like it even less. Well, two reports this week do throw light on why they would like it even less. One, from the Inspector General, is on police training in Afghanistan. And, of course, that's crucial to our exit strategy. The police, which are really security forces, will take over more and more, you know, along with the Afghan army, and we'll be able to leave. Well, according to this report, the military, our military, has consistently overstated the progress made in this training. We've spent $27 billion on it. And as of the end of March, barely 25% of the Afghan army and 12% of the police force were given the top ratings. In one district, the inspector general looked at, 53 officers were authorized, 23 were trained, and only 6 of them could be found. This is after spending $27 billion. The other report, Warlord Inc., Extortion and Corruption Along the U.S. Supply Chain in Afghanistan, from the Subcommittee on National Security and Foreign Affairs in the House. This documents the extent to which the trucking of all supplies, which is how everything pretty much gets into Afghanistan, is supporting, the contracts for the trucking are supporting warlords who guard the roads. It's supporting extortion and bribery as they, you know, to get your truck from one place to another, and it's supporting, people are quoted as saying this, payment to the Taliban. That is to say, to get shipments through, these warlords are paying off the local Taliban. So in effect, we are paying for both sides in the war, for our side, and at least in this way, for the Taliban as well. Mm.
Jack, one of our listeners, Raul, wants to weigh in on this. Welcome to the program from Columbia, South Carolina. Hello.
Hey, Jane.
Hi.
I wanted to make a comment. The appointment of General Petraeus, I think, is very disturbing. It just accentuates the fact that the American media is more concerned about the private lives of our commanders rather than the public lives, and I wanted your opinion on how this is going to affect the rest of the war and what the American people view on the Afghan war.
All right, Raul, thank you. Amy Sullivan.
Well, I guess I'd have to take a little bit of issue with Raul on the idea that the replacement of General McChrystal with General Petraeus is a reflection of a concern about the private lives. I think the president was in a difficult but a position where he had no choice but to make that replacement, if nothing else, to make clear that both the administration and the military establishment are on the same page. As difficult as Afghanistan is, it is made almost untenable when you have open hostility and open disagreement like that. But that said, you know, it doesn't mean that putting General Petraeus in that position is going to solve anything anytime soon. And I don't think that anyone at the confirmation hearings was under that delusion either.
Gail Chadwick, Democrats in the House begrudgingly approved an additional $37 billion to fund the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan on Thursday. So the Senate must still approve that legislation. Totals about $80 billion, I think. But this really further illustrates the divide in Congress.
No, I spent a lot of time yesterday with some of the anti-war Democrats, and they were just in a fog, in the sense that, you know, here we have, we campaigned to end this war, and here we are in the ninth year of it, yet again voting resources, not to maintain but to surge. And they just felt that, you know, the amendments they were offered were symbolic, their opposition is symbolic, and there really isn't much that they can do. I would say, picking up on Jack's point about that IG report, though, there is something very interesting that could develop here among Democrats. Senator Levin referenced that report, and he said it's very important to build capacity, and it's clear that we are nowhere near where we thought we were. You know, it's ironic, you think about the Vietnam War, and the way we counted success was the number of people we killed. And here, we're counting success by this capacity measure, how many Afghan troops are now able to stand up and fight. And Levin said, you know, the report claimed we had 120,000 in the Afghan army, maybe 70,000 in combat. Why, he said, are there only a little more than 7,000 in Kandahar? And why is it that by October, American forces are going to be going in there at a faster rate, when we all know that the answer to this is to have Afghan forces standing up and fighting the Taliban? That is, in a sense, a little benchmark. And I'll be very interested to see how many Democrats hop onto that. You know, demand better capacity figures, and especially when, if, as expected, American casualties go up, this becomes a very critical question. Why aren't Afghans there fighting themselves, given all the resources we've poured into that, building up capacity there?
Indeed, it is a good question. Let me move on right now to Supreme Court nominee Elena Kagan, who sat before the Senate Judiciary Committee this week. She generally sidestepped questions about her legal views, but expounded on the role of the judicial branch.
One of the glorious things about courts is that they do provide that level playing field in all circumstances, in all cases. And even when that level playing field is not provided by other branches of government, even when there's some imbalance with respect to how parties come to Congress or the president or the state houses, that the obligation of courts is to provide that level playing field, to make sure that every single person gets the opportunity to come before the court, gets the opportunity to make his best case, and gets a fair shake.
Amy Sullivan, Elena Kagan really didn't make any big mistakes during her confirmation hearings this week, seems to be headed for the Supreme Court at some point. What did we learn about her and who she is, what kind of justice she might be?
Well, we actually learned a fair amount. You know, one of the problems, I think, that has developed over the last few years with the rolling out of Supreme Court nominees has been the idea that you need to sell them to the public or even the Senate on the basis of their compelling personal stories. And so there was a lot of chatter when Elena Kagan was first announced as President Obama's nominee, that just simply wasn't there, that maybe she wasn't as compelling as the figures we'd seen in the past. And she certainly didn't have up from the bootstraps immigrant story of Sonia Sotomayor. But I think the hearings kind of put the lie to the idea that that's what we really need to know about our Supreme Court justices. It was really, setting aside Washington conventional wisdom, that the hearings were boring, fascinating to get a chance to hear this really quite engaging, charismatic woman go back and forth with a number of the senators. As you say, it was never really in doubt, somewhat similar to the Alito and Roberts hearings, that she will end up being confirmed by the Senate. But still, she got a chance to engage beyond some of the issues that have dominated these hearings in the past few decades. Abortion did come up. She was questioned fairly sharply, both by Democrats and Republicans, on her views on abortion law. But so did a whole wealth of other issues, including kind of the philosophical question of whether justices should view their jobs as simply umpires who are calling balls and strikes, or whether there is more flexibility and room for them to insert their judgment there. And she definitely very strongly came down in the latter camp of that, which tells us some important things about how she would approach her role on the bench.
Jack Beatty, what did you hear and see in Elena Kagan?
Well, I heard and saw a very, as Amy said, a very engaging woman. I mean, she was witty. She seemed to like the repartee. So all of that, you could just see that her personality was winning the senators, even senators who weren't going to vote for her. On the other hand, I must say, it continues to bother me that Republicans are able to nominate Supreme Court justices who can articulate the conservative outlook on the law, and they do that very successfully. And Democrats nominate people who essentially hide their philosophical perspective, I think. I mean, we didn't hear any debate here on the question of originalism, which is the idea that, you know, the Supreme Court should just be guided by the words of the Constitution and not go beyond them, versus the idea that the Constitution is a living document, that something that has to change with the times. And, you know, one question on that might have got Americans thinking about what kind of, you know, is this originalism, which seems to be catching on in the polls. Polls show now more Americans support that than the idea of living constitutionalism. That's a shame, because you could never get to Brown v. Board of Education. You could never get to Roe v. Wade. You could never get to all sorts of decisions on the basis of originalism, only on the idea of a living constitution, something that changes with the times. She never got to that.
Gail Chadwick, do you agree with Jack on this point?
I certainly he's describing what happened there, but I think the reason we didn't get to it is that the last person that went into a hearing saying, let me use this as a chance to educate the public, was Robert Bork, and it didn't end well. And I think ever since then, the template has been refuse to answer questions that may deal with issues coming before the court, which is to say, refuse to answer questions. What interested me about these hearings, and I agree with what both my colleagues have said on this, what interested me is what the Republicans did not do. You think back to that, 27-month period when President Bush's Solicitor General, Miguel Estrada, was up for a seat on an appeals court, and Democrats, in the minority at that time, insisted that he release memos as Solicitor General. The Bush White House said, we're not going to do it, executive privilege. It went on through an unprecedented 6 cloture votes, 27 months, and in the end, Miguel Estrada, who some people viewed as a very likely prospect for the Supreme Court himself, the first Hispanic on the court, bowed out. And so the question was, will Republicans do the same thing to President Obama's Solicitor General? And they didn't. It was interesting. They didn't. They felt that they were taking the high ground, that it would make the Democrats look like hypocrites, but frankly, it's too obscure a case. I don't think the public is out there saying, well, what about Miguel Estrada? No one remembers that.
Amy
but
Sullivan,
it was interesting that they didn't do it.
You know, I hear your point. Amy Sullivan, did that surprise you, the Republicans' reaction and response during these hearings?
You know, I actually wasn't that surprised. It is kind of a nice change to see that one party or the other doesn't necessarily need to use these hearings as a way of scoring points or highlighting the hypocrisy of their political opponents. But in this case, it did feel very much like Democrats during the Alito and the Roberts hearings, where and they know what the conclusion is going to be here. And there's some posturing that takes place and some trying to define the nominee as a bit of a radical. But for the most part, it was a fairly respectful back and forth, even where there were serious disagreements. And I think that was probably a good thing for the public to see.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the week in the news. Here's some other highlights from the week. After 25 years, CNN's Larry King announced he's calling it quits.
For now, for here, it's time to hang up the nightly suspenders.
The third Twilight film opened on Wednesday and made over $30 million in one night. One lucky fan at the L.A. premiere got close to the actor who plays the werewolf, Jacob.
I got a picture with Taylor Lautner right now, just what I wanted. I was down there and I got, like, basically to touch him. It was really cool, and I'm, like, shaking right now. I can't even believe I got a picture with him.
And West Virginia Senator Robert Byrd died this week at the age of 92. He came from humble roots and brought his Appalachian fiddle to Washington parties. Here's a tune from his 1978 album, Mountain Fiddler. Listeners, you can join our conversation this hour. What does Robert Byrd's passing mean for the nation and for Congress? What about the oil that continues to spill into the Gulf? I'm joined this hour by a terrific panel, Gail Chadwick of the Christian Science Monitor, Amy Sullivan of Time Magazine, and Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst. Let's begin this segment with immigration. President Obama spoke about it at American University on Thursday. He signaled his readiness to reform what he called a fundamentally broken system, and he said that Republicans were the problem.
I'm ready to move forward. The majority of Democrats are ready to move forward. And I believe the majority of Americans are ready to move forward. But the fact is, without bipartisan support, as we had just a few years ago, we cannot solve this problem. Reform that brings accountability to our immigration system cannot pass without Republican votes. That is the political and mathematical reality.
Amy Sullivan, this is the first speech of the president's devoted entirely to immigration policy. Why a speech about this now?
Well, it's interesting. This is one of the areas where the White House is finding itself really pushed perhaps further than it would prefer to go right now, particularly in an election year, mm-hmm. by grassroots support for immigration reform. This was something that the president talked about during the 2008 campaign. He made what supporters of immigration reform saw as promises that they do not want him backing down on now. In fact, a very influential voice in the Hispanic community, Jorge Ramos of Univision, accused him recently of breaking a promise by not moving more quickly on immigration reform. And all of that has kind of provided this independent momentum for immigration reform that the White House is, I think, finding it cannot afford to avoid. And the question will be whether, now having moved to the White House, that grassroots support can turn its attention to Republicans as well to find one or two co-sponsors for that effort. What is most interesting in terms of separating this from the immigration debates that we've seen in the past is that there are a few players, particularly in the business wing of the Republican Party, but most surprisingly in the religious community, who were not active before and who have really brought their pressure to bear, sitting fairly prominently at the president's speech on immigration yesterday was Richard Land of the Southern Baptist Conference. That is a new player in the immigration debate. Evangelicals have become very supportive of immigration reform in general. And in particular are supporting a pathway to citizenship, which is something new from that religious community, and combined with the Catholic Church, which has been a very long-term or long-time supporter of reforming immigration laws. That provides a pretty solid block to support whatever the White House is willing to put its political muscle behind. And again, in a midterm election year, when the White House was hoping to maybe just sit back on its heels and say, okay, we accomplished healthcare reform, we did financial regulation reform, maybe let's not tackle immigration right now, they may not have a choice.
We have a couple of calls on this point. Amy, let's take one here. Olamide is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Welcome, and thanks for waiting. Hello.
Hello, Jane. Hey, my name is Olamide, of course, and my dad is an immigrant, and I was an immigrant, luckily, and now we're a United States citizen. And I understand how why a lot of people come to this country, you know, trying to escape poverty and everything else like that. I was wondering why, what is the reasons behind why immigration is such an issue? Is it due to the fact that people don't want these individuals to become citizens? Is it a fear of the Republicans and maybe a hype of the Democrats to try to gain a lot of votes? What is the big drawback? Is there also fear that these immigrants who tend to be a lot more poor, at least from one aspect, that they'll now clog the system of needs and things that are rights of citizens? And I'll take my question off the air.
Olamide, thank you. Gail Chadwick, I'll funnel that to you. Why is this all so hard?
Well, I think all of those things and more. Some of the pushback from the border communities in terms of the dealing with the flood of immigrants in hospital emergency rooms, in schools, who's going to pay the cost, the pushback you're seeing in Arizona, should a state be able to enforce a public law? You know, Nebraska, a little town of Fremont, has taken up that charge itself. It's kind of showing up in intensity that frightens politicians. Politicians don't like things that are intense because you never know quite where they're going to bite you. And they're facing, members of Congress are facing the same kind of decision that they had to face over health care. Do we go for something comprehensive, which is going to be a very heavy lift, or do we pick out a few things that we could get broad support for and move them? Senator Durbin on the of Illinois has been pushing something called the DREAM Act that would allow children of those here illegally to go to college. This has very broad bipartisan support. I actually think that could work. But in moving these kind of sweet spots, there's concern that you would undermine support for the bigger project, which is comprehensive reform. And that really is a debate right now.
Jack Beatty, are you convinced the president is concretely committed to tackling immigration reform, or is this some rhetoric to placate some of the important voter demographics, the grassroots supporters that were referred to earlier?
I think it's more political than legislative. I just don't see that that's on the cards this year, perhaps in a lame duck session. Whereas politically, the president, I saw numbers last week, in no group has he suffered a sharper loss of support than among Latino voters. That's really significant. They expected him to deliver. He hasn't. This was the first speech. It's almost 2 years into the term. So it seems to me a political message, and the Republicans are reacting to it in that way. You know, this question of why people, of the passions this raises, I listen every morning to C-SPAN, every morning. They have this call-in program, Washington Journal, people calling in. And, you know, there is just a vein of what used to be called nativism in America. We don't want these people here. What are they doing here? There is that. It comes close to just sort of racial, ethnic prejudice. But then there's also just tremendous economic anxiety. People are calling in and saying, I can't get work, and yet there are 11 million illegals in this country holding jobs. What's wrong? Why, you know, how can we go on like this? And that is a really, at a time of recession, it probably is the worst time to try to get immigration reform, because it involves essentially saying those 11 million people will have to have a path to citizenship. And for unemployed Americans and Americans who feel in a precarious position, and that is so many, that's a very hard sell.
Jack, let's get a listener on this point again. Michael in Wayland, Massachusetts. Hi, Michael. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
Good day to you all. By the way, I just want to mention, I've always loved the way that Gail and Jack have all the pertinent facts at their fingertips. It's really impressive, and their facts are always significant to whatever is being discussed. My point today is the weak leadership of President Obama and Harry Reid. I don't understand why they don't force the Republicans to actually filibuster. I mean, you know, someone whispers filibuster in Harry Reid's ear, and he, you know, goes back to his office. Why isn't President Obama making Harry Reid make the Senate stay in session and filibuster throughout the 4th of July?
All right, Michael, thank you. Thank you. I've got to move on here. Our time is short and getting brief here. Let's go to the Gulf as the hurricane season kicks off. Of course, the ongoing BP oil spill officially labeled this week the largest oil spill ever in the Gulf of Mexico. And at a news conference on Tuesday, Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal said that the federal government's response has been much too slow.
We have learned that there's approximately 179 skimmers that will be coming to the Gulf Coast over the next several days. That's certainly good news, but our message has been it is over 70 days since the explosion. Where have those skimmers been?
Amy Sullivan, EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson, is heading back to the Gulf today after giving BP a new directive on how to deal with the cleanup of the massive oil spill, requiring more specific plans, waste reports, tracking systems for liquid and solid waste. I mean, it's much very detailed. I'm wondering how it took so long and why it took so long.
Well, it absolutely is becoming very clear that the White House was extremely slow out of the gate on this disaster, you know, overshadowed by the Rolling Stone article about General McChrystal was another one recently about the BP oil spill. And it provided fairly damning evidence that the White House just both did not have the facts behind it, but was also making fairly damaging arguments in terms of moving towards a swift resolution of this once this bill happened. You know, one of the things that they were saying from the very beginning was that this would result in the loss of about 5,000 barrels of oil a day, when in fact what agencies and the industry both knew was that we were looking at probably a mean loss of at least 50,000 barrels. Now, that's a huge difference. And the fact that that was kind of setting what the response was coming out of the White House was a problem. The other thing they were doing was continuing, I think, to want to not beat up too much on BP from the very beginning. They continue to say that our interests are aligned, that, you know, what BP is doing here and what we're doing is working for the same result, which is not quite true, and ended up kind of tying some strings around what their possible options were. You know, there's no question that BP wants to resolve this situation, but not necessarily in the same way. What they would prefer is to be able to cap this well in a way that it was usable in the future. And that isn't always the best way to go about capping it and just ending the gush of oil that's going into the Gulf. There, it may be that the best way to have done that would just permanently destroy the well and make it unusable in the future. The government just kind of tied its own hands by insisting from the beginning that they were working along the same lines as BP and not at least publicly acknowledging that there could be some cross purposes here.
Of course, Hurricane Alex this week creating choppy seas in the Gulf. Hundreds of oil skimmers had to be docked. Many of those people are hoping to get back to clean up today. Let's move on to Senator Robert Byrd, who died this week. He was the longest serving senator in the history of Congress. Here's a 2001 floor speech where he bemoaned the cost of running a modern campaign. He recalled spending over only $50,000 on his first Senate race in 1958.
If it had depended upon money, I would have been out at the beginning. I would never have gotten to the first base. The current system is rotten. It's putrid. It stinks.
Gail Chadwick, times changed a lot in the 52 years nearly that Robert Byrd served in the Senate. He changed with it. What was the legacy he left as the longest serving congressman in the history of the body?
I think what is most memorable about him is what he knew and how he came to know it. I spent some time recently looking at his papers in an archive in West Virginia, and there was a point where there was a debate about a line item veto and whether that the president should have line item veto. Well, Byrd loved spending money, especially in West Virginia. He chaired the Appropriations Committee, and he plunged into research on the Roman Senate, not of the Empire, but of the Republic. He had 80 volumes, three ring binders, packed, the Library of Congress sent them over, with, you know, biographies of Roman senators, heavily annotated in his own hand, underlined, and then he delivered all these speeches from the floor of the House, from memory, and then he wrote a book about it. And he lost. It was the Supreme Court in the end that said, no, 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 you really can't give the president the right to undo what Congress has done. That violates the Constitution. But I loved the way this man learned and remembered. He had a vast memory. He knew more about how the Senate worked, about its precedents and its rules, and he loved it. And he conveyed that to both Republicans and Democrats, and there isn't anyone even close to him in that capacity. And we're really sort of wondering who now will stand up as the voice of the Senate in the face of what often seems a convenient thing, just let the president do it. He's so much more, or she is so much more visible, articulate. The Senate is just, you know, fighting people. And Byrd could remind people what the concept of the Senate was and why it's so critical, even to the point of defending minority rights, which was the last big speech he gave, defending the rights of Republicans to filibuster, because he said, we could be in the minority tomorrow.
Last 30 seconds, Jack Beatty, you get the final word on this.
Well, I every Valentine's Day, he would give a tribute to his wife. I think her name was Irma.
Irma.
Yeah, and she died several years ago. And the last time I saw him do it, it was perhaps 2 years ago, and he looked up to the sky and he said, Irma, I'm coming. You wait. I'm coming. My love is here. And it was, there wasn't a dry eye in the place. His hand was shaking. He was looking up. And we'll never see anyone like that again.
An appropriate way to end. Jack Beatty, thank you very much. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
Amy Sullivan, contributing writer to Time Magazine. I appreciate your time today, Amy. Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
And Gail Haddock, congressional reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, thanks to you.
Thank you, Jane.
You can continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Enjoy the holiday weekend. Tom Ashbrook will be back on Monday. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.